Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
It is a Champions League evening. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent is with us. Evening.
Evening from London, if not Bucharest or Madrid.
Ah, dear. What channel will you watch on over there? BT?
BT, yeah. That's the standard for it.
Is it available on ITV this weather?
No, it's not. I don't even think they have highlights anymore. Wow. Which is a shame given I actually have to do something today on United's game with Barcelona in 94, the home game. And this, one of the reasons I absolutely love the Champions League is having grown up with all those games feeling like massive events on terrestrial television. And it is a complaint we've seen in England a little bit where, I remember doing a piece about 2 years ago about what Champions League's become, all these great comebacks. And I got a lot of responses saying, yeah, it's just a pity a lot of us can't watch it properly or have to go to a pub because BT is quite expensive and a lot of people don't justify it. I'm not sure that numbers are actually that high, which is remarkable, really.
Yeah, it's a pity. I mean, our childhood was Bill and the Three Lads and it was RTÉ every night and obviously TV3 have then come in, now Virgin, but it's still, pretty good deal for Irish viewers, and the Manchester United 90s odyssey was just a part of the landscape. I mean, it's a kind of sad thing to think that the next generation didn't see Mbappe and Haaland announce themselves last week.
That's exactly it. It doesn't have the same kind of, mass effect on the public consciousness as it did back then. You're right. I just associate those days with United's holy grail and kind of long nights of the soul in European football before they finally cracked it. And I suppose we're not quite getting this. And even actually, if you go back a decade ago, I mean, Mbappe's performance last Tuesday felt a little bit like Messi's 4 against Arsenal in 2009-10. And there were, I suppose, similar stages of career. Messi had been kind of like arguably the greatest player of the year for 2 years. But it felt like that was the night where he went on to another level, the kind of quality of the goals and the way he ripped Arsenal apart. And it felt similar with Mbappe, but the audience is obviously much smaller.
Yeah. You were writing about this game this evening through the prism of Luis Suarez, always an interesting character. He starts up front for Atletico this evening. And you were making the point on the London Independent website, and people can check the piece out, that Suarez is a mental technique he uses to ensure he's at his most frenetic for these big games. And you said that the Uruguayan focuses on perceived injustices or previous controversies to rile himself, so he's at his rampaging maximum. So, for instance, Chelsea, you said, well, there's that defeat, the slip from Steven Gerrard in May 2014. I was like, yeah, I get how that would be a nice source of motivation. And then secondly, Chelsea were also the opposition for one of the biggest controversies of his career when he bit Ivanovic. And that is a sentence that still reads remarkably. It sure does. And I'm wondering, how does Suarez feel like he was the victim in the Suarez biting Ivanovic saga?
Well, I mean, this, I suppose it's, so the way he presented it, apparently, and he has written about this in his book, actually, it obviously wasn't the biting, like he's accepted he was wrong there. And to be fair, he's actually quite mature when he talks about it, given the absolute immaturity and oddness of the act.
Yeah.
But what he talks about is the way he felt in England after a pariah. Like he makes specific mention of David Cameron calling him an appalling example, and plays it all up as if the reaction was absurd and he was public enemy number one. And that's the sort of thing that gets into his head. And like when I was talking to people about it, like I was speaking to someone who used to work with Suarez on a daily basis, so I knew him quite well, and talking about kind of the way he goes through all this. But what it immediately reminded me of was Michael Jordan in The Last Dance, where he would, I suppose there were so many stories in that where Jordan is talking about some, a perceived insult he's had that never actually happened. But it just serves his focus in that moment. And there really seems a lot of that with Suarez. And what someone said to me, who has worked with Suarez and a fair few top players, was that, I mean, the line was that a lot of great players, yes, they have that iron mentality, but it's still their talent that governs that. Like, the talent is the main basis. Whereas with Suarez, it's basically, it's almost the will that's more influential than the talent. And as I wrote in the piece, that almost feels symbolic in the way he actually plays. I mean, one of the images I always associate him with Liverpool, maybe it's not so much these days because he's changed his game, but when he used to get on the ball, just put his head down and kind of almost burrow his way through defences, like as if he was taking no for an answer, or he wasn't taking no for an answer, and was just looking to get through that gap no matter what.
It was a very striking dribbling technique in that there wasn't a huge amount of technique, but it worked too often for it not to be very deliberate and consistent in its own weird way. But I mean, it would like he'd almost knock it against the player and then it would come back against his shin and bumble through the player's legs, and you thought, well, how is he, as you said, almost just charged his way through there? But it just kept happening. Yeah.
Well, that's exactly it. And I suppose let's not overlook it either. It's because there was that element of erratic chaos about it, but also his ability to react quicker than people and pretty amazing control. I mean, there were some seriously distinctive goals in that regard. Like, I mean, the one I think that always stands out for me, even though it's not necessarily his most spectacular goal, but the way he took it on the chest against Newcastle that time is just, it's almost unique as I feel like I can't think of too many goals like that or too many moments in football like it. And that's what he's capable of producing. And it's, you know, the danger for Chelsea tonight in that Atletico, I mean, this has been a long-running thing with them, their quest for the Champions League. They've never necessarily been the best attacking side. It's usually been defence-based and they're hard to break down. But he just gives them that ingenuity and the possibility of something out of nothing that they've really lacked.
You made the point as well in your piece, some around Liverpool, you've obviously been talking to different sources around Suarez, some around Liverpool even genuinely felt that his 2013-14 form was a kind of bizarre sense of, quote, personal revenge, end quote, towards Brendan Rodgers for not letting him leave the previous summer. And this jumped out to me because in that pre-season, Off the Ball ran a competition for listeners to go over and play on the Anfield pitch, you know, and then get to see a training session afterwards, you know. So it wasn't like a big media presence, but people weren't there. I'm confusing too. I was over to interview Brendan Rodgers. That's what it was. I was suddenly thinking, why weren't all the competition winners with me in the stadium? So anyway, waiting to interview Brendan Rodgers after a Liverpool training session, they were training on the pitch at Anfield, but there was not it was an empty stadium. I was one of less than a handful of people watching. And Suarez was acting out. I mean, this was around the time, you know, this was just after Arsenal came in with the 50 million and £1 bid and, you know, all that was going on. And Suarez was acting out. Like, it was so dramatic. He was just booting balls away. He wasn't really paying attention. He wasn't doing the drills he should have done. And, like, it was extraordinary to kind of witness it, you know. If I had any sense, I would have been streaming the whole thing before being promptly kicked out of the stadium. But that's why your line jumped out at me. Like, you wouldn't have watched that session and thought, geez, he's a happy camper here. But then he went on and had this angrily brilliant season. And so that's why when you had that quote from somebody saying, like, almost it was a sense of personal revenge against Brendan Rodgers, even though, like, it makes sense and it doesn't make sense, I really think that person is onto something, whoever that source is.
It's just basically, it's him kind of clinging on to every door and I'll show you, or even, I mean, who knows what way his mind works in that regard, but even in a sense, I'll play myself out of this club. Because to be fair, I mean, one thing that should be said about all that was Steven Gerrard played a pretty influential role, and that was him that kind of made the penny drop for Suarez, and he told him, look, why are you wasting, I mean, with no disrespect to Arsenal, but I suppose it's true given what they became around that period. His argument, why are you wasting your great talent by going to Arsenal and kind of rushing a move where you have another great season here and the two Spanish two who you really want to go to, they'll act.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what happened. And I suppose, again, yeah, if that was the kind of element of personal revenge, he'll play his way out of the club. Well, it spectacularly worked.
It sure did. And in fairness, he was amazing then for a few years thereafter. And this season again, 16 league goals. Generally, the sense you got from people around Suarez, a well-liked teammate?
Well, this is it. And I mean, because let's be fair, if you look at the rap sheet from his career, would obviously, and as I mentioned the piece, above anything else, what is probably the most ugly recent incident in recent English football history, bar probably John Terry and Anton Ferdinand, which was the getting found guilty for racial abuse of Patrice Evra. And when you look at stuff like that and the bite, I mean, that is a really unpleasant a rap sheet. It's just it doesn't paint a good picture of someone at all, and you know, right down to a racial incident, which is the ultimate negative, especially given the way the discussion around all that has developed over the past few years. And yet, when you talk to people around Suarez or former teammates, it's impossible to find anyone to find a bad word that would say a bad word about him, which is basically why the Liverpool players backed him in what now seems one of the most ill-advised decisions in the recent history of the club. But he's just seen as a kind of a likable guy, but someone who is just completely different on the pitch to his actual personality because of that ultra competitiveness. And it can be, it is a little bit hard to square to when people talk about that. And I don't want the piece to be a defense of him or to paint what he's like as a positive given that. But that's the picture that's built from talking to people around him.
This is an interesting game tonight for a whole host of reasons. Chelsea topped Group E. Obviously, this was Frank Lampard's Chelsea who topped Group E ahead of Sevilla, and Atletico finished second behind Bayern. We know Chelsea's domestic form, and we know Atletico are top of La Liga. They're 3 points ahead of Real Madrid. They do have a game in hand. However, their most recent form is a touch shaky. A couple of draws in there, just one win in four. One of the really interesting things about Simeone this season, and I haven't seen much of Atletico, so I'm really looking forward to the game tonight, is that, I mean, the ultimate 4-4-2 merchant has been mixing things up, often playing a 3-1-4-2. I think tonight it's a 3-4-2-1 with Suarez leading the way. But Simeone is, I mean, I'm sure the DNA is similar, but he's mixing things up a touch, it would seem. Have you seen much of them?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be as aggressive as ever. It's just aggressive in different areas of the pitch because the main difference, I mean, as I was saying, in all of these Champions League campaigns and even when they won the league in 2013-14, this was a team that was defence-based and would hit you in the break, but would often mean that they'd draw a few games, kind of nil all or one all, or not make that breakthrough. Whereas now, because of Suarez, they actually play much closer to the goal and the whole team has basically shifted 30 yards up the pitch with a lot of players like Correa and Lamar doing the work that Suarez would have done for Messi. So, I mean, it's an interesting one that regard, as regards Suarez that as well. I mean, he's using his rejection from Barcelona as his personal revenge this season. But yet, given what they wanted from him and the direction of the team and his career, Barca were actually probably right to get rid of him, as mad as that sounds. But, I mean, allied to that, part of his response is also because I was thinking about this doing the piece as well, and it almost warrants a kind of bigger discussion itself. I can't think of two people in terms of a player and manager relationship as suited to each other in terms of their outlook, or at least in terms of kind of how they draw on aggression and defiance and resilience as Suarez and Simeone. I mean, you've probably only got similar examples in, Keane and Ferguson, you know, Cruyff and Guardiola, Xavi and Guardiola maybe, but there aren't too many to match in terms of this. And Simeone is the perfect manager to bring that out with him. And, you know, Suarez almost seems to personify the Atletico sense of fight in that regard. But in terms of this game also comes at an interesting time. I mean, you mentioned their slight drop-off recently. This game comes at an interesting time as regards, for all the respect we have for Atletico and the almost fear there is about them, they're top of a Spanish league that is suffering real problems in Europe and has led to growing talk about a crisis in Spanish football. There's just a series of terrible results. And it'll be interesting to see if the two Madrid clubs can arrest that tonight and tomorrow. But it's amazing how it happens, given, you know, still 2 years ago, we were talking about Spain always dominating the Europa League. They dominated the Champions League through these three clubs, Atletico Real Madrid and Barcelona. Whereas now it's as if they've suddenly just fallen off a cliff. And I think it almost is worth investigating the reasons for that. And it's why tonight will be so interesting, because whether you just, you know, a country or a team's aura goes, an opposition side suddenly realise, hang on, we can get at these, which is almost what happened last week in the second half between Paris Saint-Germain and Barcelona. And who knows, it might be similar tonight with Chelsea, because there is a lot of respect from Chelsea towards this Atletico. But let's see how it pans out.
I do want to ask you about Tuchel and what you've made of him, but just some breaking news, if you'll allow me, Miguel. Tiger Woods has been taken to hospital. He's been injured in a single car crash near Los Angeles, according to LA County Sheriffs. Emergency personnel extricated Woods from the vehicle using the jaws of life. He's been taken to a local hospital for his injuries, and his condition is unknown at this time. So that is some breaking news. Tiger Woods injured in a single car crash near Los Angeles, according to LA County Sheriffs. Emergency personnel extricated Woods from the vehicle. They had to use the jaws of life to cut him from the vehicle. He's been taken to a local hospital and his condition is unknown at this time. Obviously, we'll keep you up to date on that. Sorry, Miguel, to spring that on you and segue back into football. That's news just breaking. Yeah, extraordinary. Hopefully everything's okay. So on Tuchel, it's noticeable that Callum Hudson-Odoi starts this evening. I'm sure he's kind of going, Thomas, what's the deal here? Do you like me? Do you not like me? So 31 minutes substituted. Jamie Carragher last night making the case that he shouldn't have been substituted. It certainly wasn't his work rate was the point Carragher made, and he demonstrated with some fairly convincing pictures, I thought. Tuchel, generally, I must say I've been kind of impressed by him.
Yeah, I mean, I've electronically attended a lot of his press conferences now, and I really like him. I think he talks about football brilliantly. Mm. To be honest, like from that regard, he is several levels above Frank Lampard. I mean, without putting too fine a point on it, it's like when you hear Tuchel talk about football and you hear Lampard talk about football, it's actually embarrassing that Chelsea persisted with such a rookie for so long. I know that sounds remarkable, but it's true. Just the way Tuchel can expand on things. He is close to a genius in that regard, which a lot of people who worked with him say. But the flip side of that genius is that he can be histrionic and a bit dramatic. And this incident with Callum Hudson-Odoi feels the first indication of that. At the same time, though, I do wonder whether it's a little bit strategic and he feels Hudson-Odoi is one of the players that he can make an example of in this regard, precisely because he's been very specific in how he's brought Hudson-Odoi back into the fold. He's given him a role that he didn't have under Sarri or Lampard. And he's almost been kind of like the chosen player so far, playing a really specific role in the team. So that's why I wouldn't read too much into it, all the more so because Hudson-Odoi is back in today. But it's going to be interesting to see how these situations develop.
Yeah, I must say, I haven't sat in on all his press conferences, clearly, but anytime I hear him talking about football, his answers are incredibly detailed, well thought out. I mean, he's obviously an unbelievably smart, deep thinker in the game. And I would say as well, in his even just in his less detailed post-match interviews, there's an authority about him that for some reason didn't jump out at me in the same way when he was at PSG, maybe because I wasn't watching interviews in English or whatever. But I mean, right from the off, I think he's looked at this and said, I've got 18 months, I'm just going to do this my way and frankly, to hell with everyone else.
Yeah, I think so. And just in terms of how he talks about football, journalists are really guilty a bit too much of, you know, reading everything through the prism of press conferences, which is only a slice of people. But one of the things press conferences do, or what they should be, they obviously shouldn't just be a game where you're trying to get a manager or someone to say something that's a headline or whatever. Mm. It should actually be talking about football. And one of the great shames of modern Mourinho, which is why I really liked talking to Tuchel in that regard, is that Mourinho, when he was at his best and when he was relaxed, if you threw a football question at him, like when he was asked to talk about Messi or something like that, he used to be absolutely brilliant. And he'd really break down and he was like, you were getting an education when he talked. We don't really have that some more because, you know, Mourinho's obviously using his press conferences for all sorts of other different angles. But with Tuchel, there's a sense of that as well. And again, that wasn't something you saw with Lampard. With Tuchel, you throw something at him and he's willing to get into it. Like a few weeks ago, ahead of their game against Spurs, we got him talking about his coaching method, which is guided discovery or the principle, and the kind of different spectrums within that, whether it's kind of giving players constraints and letting them learn for themselves, or closer to the Guardiola side, which is where it's more prescribed and almost everything is drilled. And he was talking about the different situations and that, and how different players react in a different way, and the way all he tries to do is guide players to a certain point where they have options that they can use their own innovation. And he was fascinating talking about it.
Yeah,
even the other
day,
Jacob asked him about. Why, Jacob Steinberg asked him about why German coaching and pressing is at the forefront of the game. And he basically goes, unfortunately, we don't have time in this press conference.
Wow. Yeah, really interesting. So this should be a really good game. We'll get a good sense of where Tuchel is early days with Chelsea. Before you go, just wanted to get your initial thoughts on this. This is kind of breaking news today, so I know you've been otherwise engaged. MTK football is now a thing. So boxing promoters MTK Global have confirmed a move into the world of football agency. And look, there is money to be made, as we know. No real details regarding clients have been revealed. And to be fair, there's no real detail on what part of the world they're going to focus in on initially. But look, the English game is pretty lucrative, so why not start there? MTK, of course, founded in 2012 by Daniel Kinahan, who has since severed ties with the operation, but recently admitted he's still very much advising boxers and involved in that sport. I'm not sure to what extent he plans on being involved with advising footballers. But I would think, Miguel, post-Panorama, this will be looked at now pretty seriously by football journalists when they get around to it in the next few days.
Oh, yeah. And there's already been, I think, a lot of journalists switching on to this, getting into it. I mean, it's interesting. Since that Panorama documentary came out, there have been a lot of murmurs about how they were about to get involved in football, or there were already some links. I suppose we're discussing the subject, because we always have to be very careful about what we say. But football, as the biggest sport in the world, the most universal sport in the world, it's where the most money is. It's pretty natural any agency would look to eventually develop into it. But what's going to be very interesting, I think, is not just about how the UK media, or any media basically, has deal with it post-Panorama, but also what the reaction is going to be for any players who sign up to them. From the early indications and what I've heard, I think they'll probably concentrate on the UK market more than anything else. It's an interesting one for players as well. Because after Panorama, they've got a choice to make there too. Mm. How that's going to be received.
Yes, how it'll be received and how it's going to play out over the next couple of weeks, and we'll be keeping a close eye on it. Miguel Delaney of the London Independent. Enjoy the game. Thanks, Mil.
Cheers. Thanks, Joe.
And our football coverage on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. I mentioned that breaking news. We'll try and bring you more details as we get it. Tiger Woods has been taken to hospital. He's been involved in a single car crash this morning, Tuesday, over in LA. Was cut from the vehicle by the jaws of life. Significant damage to the car, or the Jeep, it would seem. So that's real breaking news at the moment. We're going to try and get someone over in the States after 8 o'clock and bring you more detail on that. But that's the breaking news on Tiger Woods in the last while.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Second half just starting in the Champions League this evening. Nil all between Atletico and Chelsea. 46 minutes on the clock. Meanwhile, for Bayern, it's cruise control. 3-0 up after the first 45 minutes of this tie. Lewandowski opened the scoring. And Leroy Sané scored just on the stroke of halftime. So 3-0 up, and that's the away leg as well. Bayern had been in, by their standards, don't overstate things, so-so form in the build-up to this game. But they're in good shape already. And Atletico, Chelsea, Diego Simeone, you suspect, won't be too upset going to London with a nil-all in his back pocket. So we'll see how that one transpires over the next 45 minutes or so. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent with us. Good evening.
Hi, Joe.
I should mention as well, earlier on, Leeds 3-0 winners at home to Southampton. They're really having an amazing season. Bielsa. It will be interesting to see if anyone comes looking for Bielsa. John Giles here made the point, could you imagine Bielsa with Manchester United's players? And I can't get that out of my head. I think it would be quite something.
I can't see it, Joe. I can't. I think, like, surely Bielsa has, like, had a volatile relationship with certain clubs. He's, you know, he's walked out of places, and, you know, he's had short-lived stays in other places. I'm not so sure. I think it's a perfect marriage there. I mean, like every marriage, it clearly has its up and downs. There's clearly the odd flaw, but, I mean, he's pretty happy there. You can sense there's a bit of contract chat and all of this, but I can't imagine he's gone anywhere else, really.
I suspect, like most people, Tiger Woods has come to dominate your evening a little bit.
Yeah, it has. I suppose, like, you know, it's news, isn't it? Like, I watched that Tiger Woods documentary recently, the two-parter. I think we might have spoke about it on the show one night. And, like, the one thing that struck me about it more than anything was, like, I didn't realise there was that much of Tiger Woods, you know, as a baby, you know, in his early days in it. And I just end up feeling like, you know, every bit of his life is, like, drama, you know. Like, there's nothing we haven't seen, you know. I vividly recall being in a pub, these things that you used to go to back in a different time, watching the news come through of the 2009 crash, and actually watching it in a place, and it's sort of surreal to be looking at, you know, CNN or American news channels, to be following another episode in Tiger Woods' life, you know. It's hard going. You know,
if you're just tuning in and not too sure what we're referring to, so just after kind of 20 past 7 territory, Los Angeles County Sheriff's released a statement confirming the rumours which were swirling, as they tend to, on social media, that Tiger Woods had been hospitalised, and this followed a single vehicle rollover crash this morning. So Woods was removed, they said, using the jaws of life, and the car sustained major damage, according to the statement. No other people in the car with Woods, no other cars involved in the accident. Then his longtime agent, Mark Steinberg, emerged and said that Woods is in surgery. We understand he still is in surgery, but he has suffered multiple leg injuries. No more detail on that, just multiple leg injuries. We don't know the nature of the leg injuries, just multiple leg injuries, and presumably that's what the surgery is in relation to. The LA Times, probably more than most, able to get people on the scene, so they've been out speaking to law enforcement sources, and they spoke to the law enforcement sources on the condition of anonymity, because they're not authorized to speak about it, but they couldn't resist speaking to the LA Times nonetheless. So they said, on the condition of anonymity, that Woods was traveling at a high rate of speed and that he lost control of the vehicle before crossing the center divider, and his SUV rolled multiple times before coming to a halt. The sources described his condition as moderate to critical. Moderate to critical. I mean, that's a big old spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the reportage of some of this stuff in America is incredible, really. You know, I mean, even that it was very early, it was a very early confirmation that the person in the car was the golfer, you know, Eldrick Tiger Woods. They just handle these things differently, don't they? You know, I mean, like, I found myself looking at TMZ or these sites, and the information they get, like, you know, they always seem to get the audio recording of, like, emergency services phoning it in or whatever. It's sort of, there really is no privacy with this stuff for them. I know it's ironic, like, people in the media talking about that, like, you seek information and stuff like that, but considering the crash happened, what, 4, 5, 6 hours ago, the level of detail, and detail that lends itself to speculation, no matter what way you look at it. But there is just such massive public interest that nothing is sacred, nothing is off limits, really. And as you say, you know, law enforcement sources are able to give a pretty good rundown. But as I said, they're able to name him in a statement. Like, in other places, it wouldn't be official channels that would be naming this. It would obviously be speculation about someone being in an accident. But it wouldn't be as public as it seems to be in America, for whatever reason.
No. Certainly the privacy aspect is very different, and obviously the defamation aspect is incredibly different over here.
It is, but it's his whole life. It's whole life is played out publicly.
Yeah. You know? I can never quite work out. So say, you know, the revelation from official channels, like the LAPD statement was almost the first I saw of it on Twitter, kind of officially after all the rumours. It's hard to know if that's just a more mature way of doing things. Like, the reality is these rumours get out, so let's just deal with them officially, as opposed to hours and hours of rumours swirling. I mean, the logic would generally be, certainly in this side of the world, or my understanding of how newsrooms tend to operate, is that one of the main reasons official channels don't identify and comment is that it's seen as reasonable to try and make sure all family members are aware of something like this happening first. So by my maths, the accident happened 7:12 a.m. plus 8, that's 15:12. So just after 3 o'clock Irish time, and it's officially confirmed 4 hours later. Like, it's very conceivable family members mightn't have got word by then, you know, but who knows.
100% I think that is 100% a thing. I mean, I can't think of examples off the top of my head, but I suppose you think of examples arising from, you know, stuff you hear about someone being unwell or something untoward happening or whatever, and that's always the guiding principle. Like, who wants to be the person that, I mean, you know, certainly not for me anyway, like, to break some kind of story. And then you hear afterwards that, like, you know, it was a family member found out by virtue of your story. I mean, that's just not worth it, really. But, I mean, I know what you're saying. Like, obviously, if there's speculation going around and pictures or whatever it might be, I understand why you get ahead of it, you know, in some respects at official level. But, yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's something that I suppose we're, sadly, like, everyone's, you know, As I said, there's no privacy. We're going to be watching this. Possibly those that are interested are going to be watching this, like, on rolling news in a sort of a voyeuristic way. But that's what happens. That's, you know, that's what we do.
It's really terrible. I mean, if this was the end, look, first of all, you hope it's not critical. I mean, moderate to critical was used there. You hope he's okay. Certainly the sense that Steinberg, his agent, gave was it was about leg injuries, and that's the starting point. So you hope, first of all, he's okay. And then you think, man, what a brutal way. If this could be the end of his golfing career, you know, so conceivably at his age, we last saw him at the Genesis on Sunday night. He was the tournament host. I don't know where you're watching.
Yeah,
he was being interviewed by Jim Nance on TV, and he's obviously had back surgery, if people didn't see that before Christmas, and so Nance was asking him where he is with that, and even that was a murky enough picture. He was saying that he doesn't know if he would be back for the Masters in April. He didn't know if he'd be able to get back and play a warm-up event. He was due another MRI scan to see where he was, and it was all, you know, really up in the air. And that was his, I think, fourth or fifth back surgery. I mean, it's been a complete mess, really, his back, and he's had spinal fusion and all sorts there. So that's where his head was at on Sunday. So, I mean, to throw in the inevitable complications now that will come with this, I mean, that could really be the end of Tiger Woods' golf career, and a brutal end at that.
Yeah, no, like, I mean, as I said, like, you're wary of speculation, like, so soon after the crash. Sure. As well, like, you know, because, like, this is the thing, that's my point about the news cycle. I probably should have made that point there. Of course, like, you know, these stories get out, but it's just how quickly it happens in America sometimes, like, how quickly it happens.
Yeah.
So, like, even with the Kobe Bryant case and stuff like that, just incredibly how quick it can filter out. But yeah, so you are right. I mean, if that is the way, was it Ben Hogan involved in a big car crash at some, in the golfing past? You know, that it's very sad, certainly. Yeah,
it's terrible. Yeah. Well, hopefully the big picture stuff is okay. I mean, that's the most important thing at this vantage point. And it's, you know, 2-3 hours, 2 hours since the news even began to break, and as we last heard, he's still in surgery, so this is incredibly early to say anything more. So look, we'll keep you updated. If you're just tuning in, we wanted to bring that news to you. It's obviously significant, and we will get back to matters football. So still nil all between Atletico and Chelsea over in the game between Lazio and Bayern. Two more goals have gone in. Lazio did get one of them, but Bayern also got one of them, so it's now 4-1 to Bayern away to Lazio this evening. Dan, MTK, we haven't talked about MTK on the football show, but they are expanding. MTK Global, very much operating in the world of boxing, set up by Daniel Kinahan under a different name in 2012. And now they are moving into the world of football. They made the announcement. They have a CEO, and Miguel Delaney was on saying it's his understanding that they're certainly going to be looking at the UK market. They mentioned that Danny Vincent, 36 years old, is going to front MTK Football, a strong passion for football. And I said to Miguel Delaney that post-Panorama investigation, this will not go unchecked over in the UK press. And he was very much in agreement in saying that's already started. So very significant news. I mean, I guess it's, you know, the more you think about it, it's not shocking. There is money to be made.
No, it's definitely not shocking. And I mean, I suppose, again, you know, you don't want to sound like one of those, I suppose, the sycophantic boxing journalists or some of the stuff they've said. But it is a point to make that it's not unusual for bad money to be floating around football as it is in other codes. But that doesn't sort of lead to just taking a sort of shrug your shoulders and go, well, hey, that's the game. You know, that's what happens. But I suppose, I mean, you do look at sort of regimes that are behind certain clubs and stuff, and it would obviously, if you looked into everything in great detail, you'd be worried about a lot of things, and you'd be asking questions, and certainly people just get on with it, you know, like where World Cups go and bidding goes and all this stuff. But obviously this is something that's very close to us in particular here, because naturally we live very close to and are very conscious of the impact, that certain actions and certain people's broader network has possibly had on communities. So we have to be very, always have to be very on your guard and sort of worried about this stuff. And it's interesting, as you say, you know, Miguel alluding to the information and the situation that they may more so be looking at the UK market, without pretending to follow this story unbelievably closely. And to second guess what the mood is of everyone in the world, or, you know, and everyone in Ireland, and what it would be, I do think it would be surprising if you suddenly found, Irish footballers going down the road of signing up for them in the same way, even that I know that a number of boxers have, particularly some ones from north of the border, but I think in some respects, you know, you could argue that they they got themselves into something. But we're in a situation now where any footballer, it's a news story if it comes out that a footballer has signed. Like, if a footballer in theory put out a post tomorrow, an Irish footballer put out a post and said, happy to have signed up with MTK Football, it's a massive story. It's like probably a front page story as much as anything. So I'd be very surprised if it really, if they went down that road publicly. But obviously, in the UK, there seems to be, as much as you say about the media scrutiny, I'm not so, like, there's also people who don't seem that bothered by it, really. And listen, there's money in football. There's a lot of, you know, young men in football seeking direction, you know, and someone putting an arm around their shoulder and looking after them and telling them what they want to hear. They're going to be interested by that. So, yeah, like, I mean, it's we will see what happens, you know. As I said, it's weird, like, to be talking around and to be talking mysteriously, but probably wouldn't be the first time, but obviously this is almost, it's MTK are very much out in the open, you know, the discussion of their activities and is it appropriate. You know, if you went through who has represented every footballer in recent times, you'd probably find links of some description, but this one is out there now. So I don't know what your sense of it is. Like, you know, you've spoken to a lot of guests about it, you know, various, you know, journalists and stuff in the UK. I'd be sort of surprised. But that, you know, if, you know, MTK Football suddenly started signing up loads of clients and people shrugged their shoulders, but then, you know, you hear the statement on TalkSport and some stuff and you wonder, maybe are we in a media bubble here and a lot of other people are just getting on with it and think it's no big deal.
No, I'd be quite surprised if it wasn't a big story, especially on the back of the Panorama documentary. You know, that made such a splash over there that this won't be a case of MTK Global almost sneaking up on people, and suddenly you realise, a bit like as seems to have happened in boxing, you suddenly realise the extent of their stable, and you realise Daniel Kinahan is brokering, you know, the biggest fight in the world. It seemed to almost catch people a little bit unawares, and there's been almost a scramble since to catch up with this story in a way and digest the story and, well, what's going to be done about the situation, you know. I think it caught outside of Ireland, caught people by surprise. That won't really happen now post Panorama. So I suspect this will be a big story. And, you know, Barry McGuigan made the point that to do what they did in boxing took millions. So they were very serious about getting into the boxing market and doing well in the boxing market. I suspect they'll be very serious about getting into the football market, and they'll come fully loaded and they'll offer good terms, which is what they did in boxing. Mm. I presume the model is the same. They'll offer very attractive terms, and I think they'll start to pick up footballers, and then it will be very interesting. Now, the big question is that in football, as opposed to in boxing, there are supposed to be regulations and equivalents of fit and proper person tests and all of this stuff. There are hands-on regulatory bodies. So in boxing, one of the great issues seems to be a lack of regulation on this front, whereas in football, that is not the case. So if links can be established which are deemed not good, then will football authorities take action? I think it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see.
Although, I don't know. Like, you say that, but like, in some respects, the football stuff in recent years has become a small bit more sort of Wild Westy to a degree, in the sense that, like, there used to be, like, you know, the agent exams and a more strict thing, but now really I haven't sort of prepared this, but like, in terms of the, you know, the definition of sort of someone that's advising or an intermediary and stuff like that,
but, you know, sorry to interrupt, forget about the exams and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
front page news, public pressure. The big football journalists asking the big questions, what's going on here? Like, in boxing, there's no, who do you go to? What do you do? So that's not the case in football. There'll be high-powered people now coming under pressure. There'll be broadcasters coming under pressure, potentially. Who knows?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Clubs coming under pressure. Clubs being asked, are you going to deal with this agency given the concerns people have? Clubs will be asked that. Managers will be asked that. So I think there'll be more in this than in boxing, where, like, often the promoters and the fighters, you don't hear from them month to month, let alone a couple of times a week, as is the case in football.
Yeah, and I suppose you've got to assume, and again, this is an assumption is dangerous, because, you know, you'd assume they're going to want to go to the top of the game, but I suppose it's a question of, like, you know, if you have a very established footballer doing very well, like boxing, as we know, there's big money, you know, in it at the top end. But obviously, it seems that a lot of the people they represent are ones who say, well, they had nothing, you know, before MTK came along and they did this for them and they did that for them. Whereas generally, you know, someone who's playing at a good level of football in the UK is already doing pretty well for themselves. And so you wonder, is it going to be going after sort of younger players at an early age and build that loyalty as opposed to like making a splash in the market? Because it's very hard. Like, it's a different scene. It's about, you know, getting on the cards and getting on the fights, and you need to be with someone. Like, I'm not saying the football world is perfect. Obviously, you'll see agencies having relationships with clubs and managers, and the movement of it can be very murky at times. But I guess like going in at the top involves going in and getting, you know, high profile clients. Like, what can you do for them? You know, I suppose there's endorsements and there's various doors you can open, but you would think it's more so the sort of the vulnerable younger player needing direction, you know, but who's got a lot of talent. That's where you go and that's where you get into it. Yeah. So it's probably, it's almost at the underage football scene and, you know, parents and people and advisors who need a bit of guidance. You would think that's where you would go to start. But again, there's a massive level of assumption involved with that. And, you know, I could be talking rubbish. You know, they could have tentacles there already. Who knows?
Mm. We'll wait and see how it all plays out. It will be interesting, to say the least. Football from the weekend, I haven't talked to you much. I know you watched Seamus Coleman's Tour de Force at Anfield, Dan.
I did, yeah. I mean, we're not necessarily sort of bowled over with sort of good Irish Premier League stories at the moment. And sort of Seamus Coleman has probably been probably one of the stories of the season. I even did a piece for the paper on Saturday before that game. And to be honest, like, it was hard to do the piece with certainty that he would play, because albeit there was an injury to Yerry Mina during the week, he'd come on early against Man City. But like, Ancelotti seems to be at the stage where he's picking and choosing the games where he uses Coleman. It's sort of been one game on, one game off since Christmas. But he had a very specific plan in mind for him for this game. It was picked out by Jamie Carragher the other day on Monday Night Football, and explained how Seamus Coleman did a sort of a job on Andy Robertson. And it was interesting, yeah, that he really had a role to play in the game, which sort of showed how he still has a versatility to go with his experience to execute a task.
Yeah, it was really impressive. And he said as much in the post-match interview. He admitted, my job was just to look after Andy Robertson. And he flitted between right wing back and right winger at times, and then back four at times. I mean, yeah, it was very versatile from Everton's perspective, and it worked really well. And I guess Coleman has to make a lot of the decisions which dictate the shape of the team, and Ancelotti trusted him to do that. So it was a real marker of the trust Ancelotti has in him, the experience that Coleman has. And it would seem, Dan, that come March time, it'll be Seamus Coleman at right back for Ireland, given forms of Doherty and Coleman. I mean, that seems like almost no-brainer territory. Or will Stephen Kenny look for something else, do you think?
No. I would have thought, I think, you know, with everything that's happened, with it being an away game, a tough away game, albeit, you know, no fans, so you can't necessarily talk about the hostile atmosphere. But, you know, an away game, John Egan's out, Shane Duffy's form is struggling. You need that bit of, you know, defensively, you know, forget leadership and all those words. Like, you know, you just need maybe that sort of solid presence, someone who's in good form. You know, Kieran Clark has been doing okay at Newcastle. He might come back into the scene. And, like, you probably just need Coleman there. But I suppose, like, maybe, like, how he was used the other day was interesting, because, as you mentioned, like, he was sort of, at times he was a right wing back, at times it looked like he was a right winger. Like, sometimes when you're trying to explain football, you know, you will talk about, well, what was the system that was played, and, you know, it's always a 4-5-1 or a 3-5-2 or whatever, and you can be very we can be very direct about it. When, of course, like, then you talk to people who are involved in the game, and it's obviously a bit different. Like, they'll talk about how you might have a particular formation in possession and a particular formation out of possession, and how you can switch from one to the other depending on some fullbacks are pressed up higher than the other. And it was interesting how Everton used Coleman in this game in the context of, you would say, the debate around the Coleman and Doherty situation, because we've always, you know...
What a goal. Sorry to interrupt. Hold that thought. Giroud.
Oh, I'm just seeing it here.
With an overhead. It's been ruled out.
Offside.
Oh. Olivier Giroud. I presume it was Giroud. Maybe I'm doing somebody else a disservice. 68 minutes gone here. It's Atletico nil, Chelsea nil. And in effect, from distance, out of the corner of my eye, when Dan McDonald was 99% absorbing me with his football intellect as per Dan. But ball fell to, I think again, Giroud on the penalty spot. And he leapt up. Yeah, it was Giroud. And overhead kick. It didn't rifle into the net. It took a bounce before hitting the net, but it was so well placed in the corner, keeper couldn't get to it. And he turned away celebrating, only to see flag up. Referee is talking on his microphone now. I wonder, will they?
It just depends who had the last contact before the ball came to Giroud. Yeah. If it was an Atletico player or a Chelsea player.
They haven't restarted play yet. Referee is not coming over to a screen or anything. He's waiting for word from somebody. All the players are staring at the referee. And we are waiting. So that's interesting.
This is what we do. Well, I think he's in an offside position, but if it was a bad clearance that hooked the ball into his path, as opposed to a teammate, then maybe he has half a chance.
He's still talking.
A referee will sort of scream at us now to give a more precise definition of that. But that's I would assume that's what they're looking at. That if the ball reached him from Atletico Madrid player rather than his own player, then he's got a chance of being onside. But they're not. They're not showing us replays at the moment, so we can't really we can't call it in any more detail than they are.
Why are they not showing replays?
It's quite frustrating. We're in this holding pattern. I feel like, should I go back into the Seamus Coleman point, or are we just wait till it's clarified?
Dan, relax. A bit of silence on the radio is nothing to be afraid of.
Okay.
We'll chill. So he's talking. They're saying VAR goal check. He's still talking. I don't know why the TV aren't showing us a replay. That's the annoying thing. Just show us a replay.
I'm just embracing the silence here, Joe. No, like, you're right. It is. But, like, this is what we do now. Like, this is now a modern part of football dialogue that we just wait for a decision. But, like, the ref is walking around with his ear, listening to his earpiece very closely. It's like, you know, you see someone on the phone walking around, like, with their earplugs in, and they're a bit distracted. The players are trying to get his attention. And Simeone is pacing the line as well, nervously.
It's like dad at work and the kids want his attention. Now I'm on the phone.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm on the phone to the office here, honestly. I'm not just listening to a podcast.
I just find it strange that BT aren't taking an executive decision. Oh, has he given the goal? He has. It's a goal.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Giroud robbed of this glorious moment. Chelsea are trying to muster up a celebration now, but it's missing something.
It's sort of mad they're not giving us a replay to clarify if that's what it is. They are trying to get a celebration going. But I can only, the only logical way is that either he was not offside initially and we need to see something in the replay, or it was an Atletico Madrid player that sent it to him.
I think we need to talk about just how woeful now the Chelsea celebration has been. That is so terrible. Finally, a replay. Ball is crossed in. It's all about who gets a last touch, to be fair. So what happens here? Ball is crossed in, it bounces, and then a Chelsea player and an Atletico player go for it at the same time. Think Noel Hunt, Robbie Keane territory. And they're both, one of them, we're having to presume now it was the Atletico player.
The director is just not having this at all, is he?
No, yeah. One of them hoiks the ball up in the air. And so it had to be the Atletico player, as you rightly suggested might be the case. And Giroud slams in the overhead. Is this a Spanish director? Is this like Spanish director in a huff?
Maybe if I don't show this, it won't have actually happened.
Yeah.
This is what happened. No, we eventually, it does, the last replay would suggest that's what happened. It's the most sensible explanation.
Surely BT have control over their own pictures in a night like this.
But well, the thing is, I actually watch an RTE and it's exactly the same. So UEFA tends to be, you know, the UEFA tends to be a sort of a centralized feed for the games, you know, standardized camera positions, you know, rather than, you know, broadcasters doing their own thing. That's not necessarily I just know from the Dundalk being in the Europa League and stuff like that, I don't think, you know, teams bring their own, you know, stations, send their own camera crew or whatever. So,
Well, it wasn't good. I mean, whoever that director was made a mess of that 5 minutes.
Well, particularly for us, just as we sort of, we embraced the silence. But anyway, it was compelling. The goal was scored in the end.
I don't think we can call it compelling about ourselves.
No. And it was also ironic. But we'll go back to the Seamus Coleman point.
You were on the verge of saying that Coleman demonstrated a certain versatility. He shows he can play right wing back just like Darby.
Well, it's just a question. But the only point is, you're not playing Andy Robertson every week. But it does show that, like, the idea of Coleman and Doherty interchanging, Like the one time it was tried, it was against Gibraltar, a game where Ireland were primarily going to be on the attack, you would have thought, yeah, most of the time. But if you're playing against a team, an outstanding fullback, like a lot of decent teams tend to have, or not even outstanding, but overlapping fullbacks, it's a point to raise. Although, again, would it be a different type of player that you want? Like Doherty, you would think, also likes to cover a lot of ground. But it was interesting. Holgate was doing a job on Mane and Coleman and Robertson. I'm sure, listen, knowing the way that the Stephen Kenny and his people would watch games, I'm sure they'd have looked at it. And there was certainly chat in November that they were going to look at trying Coleman and Doherty together.
Okay.
Now, it just so happened that circumstances prevented them from doing so. But I wouldn't be shocked if it happened again.
Interesting.
At some stage, yeah.
Meanwhile, and just a quick word on this, but I don't know if you have anything jumping out to you. Everton, before that Man City, before that Brighton, before that Burnley, four losses in a row, before that draws with Manchester United and West Brom. I mean, Liverpool's fall off here is actually extraordinary. I think Carragher was making the point last night on Monday Night Football that I get the Van Dijk thing and I get the injuries and I get everything else, but actually this has now gone past the point of being acceptable. Like,
yeah,
they're 17th in the form guide for over the last while. He was saying, look, I played in far inferior teams to this and we just managed to get wins. You know, you have to start winning games. Like, this is just ridiculous now. This isn't acceptable.
No. I don't think, like, if they lose the league by 5 points, you know, yeah, I think to raise Van Dijk is a fair point, you know. And there's no doubt it had a massive unsettling effect. But again, like, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, Manchester United lost Roy Keane famously in that sort of, was it 97-98, the Alfie Gahalan, the knee injury. I don't recall them like completely falling off a cliff in the sense that they, you know, they looked like they weren't going to finish in the top four, you know. And that's clearly like a reason why things have gone bad for Liverpool, but the extent to which they've fallen off it, I mean, even if you're being really kind and saying that is the reason, well, then there's still a mental frailty question mark with that they haven't responded in the resilient way you would manner to it, you know, the resilient manner you would expect to it, you know. So that raises question marks, and it just can't, like, and it's to me it makes more sense that they're just tired generally, and the exertions of recent years have caught up with them, and that's always the challenge from going from being a good team, like a good league winner, to being like a really great one, is to do it, you know, to retain it, to consistently win it. And you know, sometimes teams, like, their flame burns brightly for a period of time and then it goes out. And I didn't think that would happen with Liverpool at all, I have to say. But the volume of defeats would make you think.
Something serious.
I don't know. Yeah, there's a bit more of a question mark. And, like, it's a weird season. It's a weird time. A lot of leagues around Europe are getting strange results. There's mitigating factors, but I just think you're denying the truth, like, to a sort of an over-the-top extent if you say that the only reason is injuries. That's not a dig at Nathan Murphy, by the way. I know he was defending it the other day. But I think there's more to it than that. You'd have to be worried.
Okay. 1-0 Chelsea against Atletico, and in the other game, this evening, still 4-1 Bayern away to Lazio. James Richardson is going to join us next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, you're welcome, Max. So, Callum Hudson-Odoi has been called ashore after 80 minutes. Far more acceptable tonight than at the weekend. Reece James, just come on. Chelsea still 1-0 up against Atletico. The general sense on Twitter is people wondering why the hell Atletico have not tried to score a goal this evening. It's been that kind of an Atletico performance, seems to be the feeling. Meanwhile, Bayern Munich still 4-1 up away to Lazio. The football coverage on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Dan McDonald is still with me, as is James Richardson, host of the official Premier League Fantasy Football Podcast. James Richardson, hello.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Very well. So this story is, what, the high point for the official Premier League Fantasy Football Podcast? Aston Villa, team news leaking out, James Grealish injured. And what's happened here? It seems that there's some way for a bot or software of some kind to keep tabs on players who are also working for football clubs, and when the Aston Villa Brigade all dumped Grealish out of their team, ahoy.
Yes. So there's an account called FPL Insider. I don't know what, to what extent it's an algorithm, to what extent it's a bot, to what extent it's a spotty fellow with a laptop in an attic. But they monitor the account, the teams, which are published when the deadline for team selection passes. Everyone's teams are published. So if you know what a team is called, you can find out who's in it. And they've obviously gone to the bother of finding out who these Aston Villa squad members, but also kind of members of the backroom staff, who their teams are, and various other teams as well. Andy Robertson's one who in the past has caused a certain amount of furore by transferring Mane out of his team ahead of the deadline, and ahead of a match. And then we all knew that Mane was probably not going to be playing. So this thing does exist, and people do follow accounts to try and get that kind of marginal gain, to get a little bit of an insight into which players are going to be playing at the weekend or which ones won't. And supposedly, because these five Villa staff members had transferred Grealish out, that was how Leicester knew, because the deadline was, 6:30 on? The deadline for Fantasy Premier League was 6:30 on Friday evening. That was how they knew, a kind of a day and a half or so before their clash with Villa. Leicester were able to prepare for a Grealish-less set of villains. I mean, to be honest, as has been pointed out, Grealish hadn't been spotted in training for the previous few days. So there were plenty of other ways this news had got out. But I think for FPL managers, this is manna from heaven, because we're desperate for credibility. We're desperate to feel like we have a role to play in the game, an impact on the Premier League. The Premier League, which we know to be really just a device for furnishing points for our league, has now become aware of our existence.
Well, indeed. I mean, this is the big time. I mean, this is it. You're the center of your eye of the storm here. This is incredible. I mean, what next? What's going to happen next?
I don't know. Supposedly, Dean Smith, in a fit of pique, has banned those five Villa staff members from playing, or indeed any staff members from playing Fantasy Premier League for the rest of this season. Rumours that he was bottom of the Villa Mini League, I think, are to be discounted. That's not what this is about. But I imagine that this could be something, if this goes any further, because clearly there is a potential advantage for someone like Leicester in knowing that a big player is out and being able to prepare themselves for that. And managers never want leaks. We've seen that with, you know, obviously Leeds in the past and that derby business. So I can see how clubs might start to take this seriously and might start to expect their players not to have fantasy teams, whether that'll actually be what happens. I mean, they'll probably just do it undercover. I mean, it's another form, I guess, of betting on which players will or won't do well. But so many players play it. Not many managers do it, I don't think, probably because they're busy actually managing. But Pep Guardiola, I think, was asked about this. Asked about the whole business, he seemed blissfully unaware of what fantasy Premier League was, but he'll run, I'm sure.
I can't believe so many players play this. Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do we have, it's almost like a secret club we're trying to find it. Like, do you know how many players have teams, you know? Because I see one of the reports is suggesting that now they might have to stop players who want to play from including players from their own club on their team, which obviously involves a red, do you have to add in an extra line, are you a Premier League player, tick box yes or no, while you're signing up at the start? But is it widely known
how many there are? My guess would be that around half of the Premier League play.
Stop.
Really, because I do a show, and a quick plug on fancy.premierleague.com. Well, you might be able to see it on Irish television, I'm not sure, but we do a show every Thursday night called Fantasy the FPL Show, with myself and Jules Breach. And we, in the course of that, are talking about which players you need to get for the weekend, and generally having a particularly entertaining time. We always do a little interview segment with a player from a Premier League club. And sometimes they don't really understand what FPL is, but loads of times they are very switched on about what metrics they need to be picking players by, who they should be recommending. And they'll often talk about who's top in that team, you know, their own team's mini league of FPL. So, I mean, Patrick Bamford's another one. The guy will not go through a post-game interview without mentioning what he's done with his team, whether he's dropped himself, whether he gave himself the captain's armband, which, as we all know, will earn you double points.
Well, of course. Indeed.
So I think that I would say at least 50%. There are 8 million people playing this game.
Whoa.
Yeah. extraordinary, no?
Wow. Is it more popular than I played it in college, and I've stopped. I just don't anymore for whatever reason. I'm rethinking this. I can't believe you think up to 50% of Premier League players who play in the Premier League are also playing Fantasy Manager. I mean, this is just blowing my mind.
Okay, so that's the difference. Fantasy Manager, I can't imagine them doing. It's incredibly
fantasy football.
But I think that's a key difference because FPL is dead simple. If you're a football player and you actually play against the people that you're picking from, you've got a very good idea of who's in form, who's not in form, who's likely to do well against a given opponent. And also, and this is crucial, you've got bags of free time. I mean, once you've kind of got your tattoo for that week, what are you going to do as a Premier League player? Yeah. I think FPL is a great pastime for them, and it's right up. Yeah, it's in their wheelhouse. It's another way they can compete with the rest of the squad. I think it ticks all the boxes.
I guess so. I guess I just the high of having a good week there, as opposed to the high of having a good week on the pitch. But then again, I did see Bamford. I mean, he was beaming, positively beaming after one game when he knew that the points haul was big. So, is 8 million players? Is that as big as it's ever been? Is this only going one way? Am I calling this a hobby, a pastime, a pursuit?
So, 8 million is the record, and that's only recently been reached. So it's curious that the numbers have been going up even during the season. I would expect that if you didn't start at the start of the season, why would you join in? But I guess people join it just to see how well they can do on a week-to-week basis. Is it going to keep on growing? I mean, I think so, although apparently we're going to lose a bunch of Premier League footballers as managers, but it's free and it's great fun, and it makes even games like Burnley against West Brom watchable if you've got skin in that game.
True. Dan, you're still at it, aren't you?
No, I just gave it up a couple of seasons ago. So I did play it for years, but I'd imagine during lockdown you see it's become like it's like good clean fun for Premier League footballers. I mean, what else have they left to do? You know, I mean, if they tell their mate what the team is going to be, they get in trouble. You know, if you have spot betting stuff going on in lower leagues and gambling and all sorts of stuff, that is the dark side of the game. You know, I mean, give them their fantasy league team at least. You know, without someone hacking it or not hacking it. I assume it's available, but this bot has managed to like access it very quickly and put it out there. But
James, I must listen because in my day. It was fairly agricultural, I think. I mean, I'm only going back maybe, 10 years or so, and like there were just certain truths. Like you picked Morten Gams Pedersen because that was just a guaranteed value for money buy. And, you know, you Frank Lampard for a couple of seasons, it was just silly not to have him in the team. I presume here we are in 2021, people have a lot more data to play around with. So has this become fairly sophisticated?
Yes, there are people. Well, I suppose I'm one of them, actually. I mean, there is a kind of entire kind of professional subclass existing off FPL now. There are people who have quit their jobs to become FPL scouts or run FPL blogs, subscription services whereby they offer tips and metrics for people who want to get the slightest advantage in their mini leagues or whatever. I mean, you can go very, very deep on this. Most FPL podcasts, not ours, I would stress, but most of them, I think, run to about 1.5 hours per episode just because they've got so much stuff to tell you every week. But if you don't want to go that deep, it's dead simple. You know, you just pick your players and then off they go. And quite often, if you just leave them there and stop interfering, they'll do far better than if you continue to meddle. So I think it is a game that is very much accessible at whatever level you want to play it. But yeah, if you want to get sophisticated, my goodness, there's just so much raw data that you can really dive into and you know, rub all over.
So who are the great undervalued players that really should be in people's teams? Yeah, who are like the hidden gems that you've come across over the last
while? Well, I think, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's increasingly difficult, especially at this time of the year when we've all had a good look at who the players are with two-thirds of the season gone. I mean, the last kind of surprise was Gundogan, who came in and kind of took over the goal scoring at Man City and is ridiculously cheap for the points that he was providing.
Yeah.
Probably Dallas. If people haven't heard about Dallas at Leeds, he's the guy. He's the real, I think, the guy who's way outperforming his expected goals. And I mean, he's a defender for a start, but also his price tag. But I think most people are across Dallas by now. I'm not really the guy to ask about this because I'm famously tactically dim about football. But luckily, there is a place that you can find out this kind of stuff with real genuine experts, and that is the official FPL podcast.
Oh, what a plug. Masterfully done.
Seamless.
Before you go, what are you making of this Serie A season? Milan derby, obviously, at the weekend. Lukaku reigns supreme.
Yes, well, he was magnificent. I'm slightly disappointed of Inter run away with it. If you were ever to pick a team that could blow it from here to the end of the season, Inter would be probably the one, because you know, the very club song celebrates the fact that they are able to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory at any given moment. But it does look like they have a significant advantage, not only their lead, but the fact that they don't have any European commitments. So they're just plain sailing from here to the end of the season. But it has been really great to see things mixed up. It's been a bit of a slap in the face seeing how Lazio and Juve have got on in this last 16 of the Champions League so far. But we're hoping for better from Atalanta tomorrow against Real Madrid, because that would be really special if the Bergamaschi could say knock Zidane's crew out of Europe.
And what's the verdict on Pirlo and Juve? What's going wrong?
Well, I refer you to my previous answer about my tactical understanding, which is, you know, close to zero. But from what I understand from reading what clever people say, it goes to the fact that he is a manager who likes to play a certain kind of football, and he doesn't have the players to do it. He lacks, ironically, a Pirlo figure. And he's tried various different combinations of players, the sum of which parts might add up to that kind of deep-lying orchestrator, furnisher of attacking play. But as yet, he hasn't found one that will work consistently. One will work for a game or two. Weston McKennie looked like he might be the solution. That hasn't been working out. So I think that this is a team that has been built around Cristiano Ronaldo's goals for so long that it's masked a lot of the kind of other absences, the other flaws in it. Cristiano Ronaldo is now looking like age is catching up with him. He hasn't scored, I think, in six games or something now. And I think that's kind of laid bare a lot of the other problems in the team. And, you know, there are other issues with injuries. The fact that Dybala's gone missing for this period with injuries has not helped Pirlo. But, you know, it's a lot to expect him in what is literally his first ever job in management at any level at all to suddenly be able to kind of sort out this puzzle. I think he will be given time by Juve. There's no way that you bring him in if you're not going to give him time. But fingers crossed, because it would be a real shame if Pirlo didn't turn out to be a genius manager, you know?
Yeah. And does the traditionalist in you look at Inter, Milan, Juve, Roma as a top four and think, yeah, look, I like that. There's a certain old school glamour here, which I'm just fine with.
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, particularly the Milanese.
Yeah.
We need to have the two Milanese sides in the Champions League. And, you know, hopefully we'll get five Italian sides in there. That would be good. But that it would be nice to get the proper sides up there and a little bit of a renaissance there, particularly, as I say, in the city of Milan.
Very good. Well, listen, thanks so much for coming on and explaining all that to us, James Richardson. Always great having the show. Thanks a million.
Not at all. Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thank you. Latest again, we're into injury time in Bucharest. Atletico 0, Chelsea 1. 6 minutes of added time there. There are 4.5 minutes of those six played, and Bayern still 4-1 up. Way to Lazio again into added time.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
It's just gone full time. Chelsea 1-0 winners against Atletico, and Bayern 4-1 against Lazio. That's a really good win for Chelsea, Dan.
Yeah, it's a huge win. I suppose, again, closed doors football, I mean, it's a different language around home and away. I mean, but the away goal still counts. it's still in the bank for you. So it's weird. Yeah, I mean, it's a great win for him. I suppose, you know, he's managed to maintain his early momentum, really, hasn't he, Tuchel? I mean, they've had the odd bad half here and there, but bottom line results are still holding up.
Just before we go, we touched on the streaming situation around the League of Ireland a couple of weeks back, and in short, and talking off the top of my head, the numbers who subscribed last season weren't deemed of as sufficient. I think it was 11,000 total, 4,000 season subscribers, and then the rest were picking and choosing games. That wasn't deemed sufficient to justify the cost of doing a full season again. So there was a worry, I suppose, or disappointment that the football wouldn't be streamed. But in a minute or less if you can. The situation now, it turns out there will be something happening.
Yeah, basically what's happening is that Watch LOI service, it looks like it's going to return until the mid-season break. So it hasn't changed in the sense that RTE are still, who are behind the sort of streaming service, Watch LOI, and they were the ones that had the concerns about the full cost. They are prepared to cover matches up until the mid-season break. Now, from that point onwards, I think RTE resources are probably channeled towards the Euros and the Olympics and stuff like that. But for League of Ireland fans, in the Premier Division level, there's going to be something there until the break. Now, I'll be quick because I know time is against us. First Division and Women's National League, they're trialling a system. It appears that it's basically, it's an artificial intelligence thing where there's an unmanned camera that tracks the ball. It's trained to follow the ball. And it's possible that that system could be rolled out at Premier level for the rest of the season if it works in the First Division. At the one point, they have it in Scotland in the Scottish Championship. It's worked very well, apart from one game where there was a bald linesman with a very shiny head, and the intelligence got confused and kept flipping to the linesman's head. So people are trying to watch the game, and then all of a sudden the camera would flick to like the linesman walking down the sidelines. So maybe, this just goes to show we aren't all going to be replaced by machines eventually, Joe. But there'll be a flaw in the system somehow.
Yes, maybe baseball caps required, or else wigs. But very good, Dan, for the time being. I'll say goodnight. Thanks, Emil.
Night, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. OTBM with you tomorrow morning. I'm sure they'll have the latest on the Tiger Woods situation. Hopefully good news on the way over the next few hours. Also with them, Graeme Hunter on tonight's football, and AFLW star Aisling McCarthy as well. We're back from 7 as usual. Wednesday night rugby, I'm sure some more news on Tiger and a few other bits and pieces. Richie McCormack in for Tom Dunn this evening. He's on the way.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Ready for your next big move? The trip from the fridge to the couch. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein powered chicken bites.